I get a lot of questions about genetic testing and what genetic tests that I run. And the short answer is I don't run any generally for methylation or figuring out what's going on pathways. And today on Ask Dr. Gill, I want to discuss why a geneticist doesn't run these tests and what the problem with them and why epigenetics is more important in understanding what's going on. Ask Dr. Gill. I'm Dr. Gill Winkelman, your host. And today on the program, I want to talk about epigenetics and genetic testing. And a lot of people write about this on Reddit or on the internet, and you know, they look at what their MTHFR is and what their COMT is. And I'm not saying that sometimes that isn't helpful. I just want to be clear about this. But there are problems with these tests. And I actually have a webinar about this as well. If you check out on my website in the upper right-hand corner on every page but the main page, the homepage, that's askdrgill.com. And in that webinar, I talk about some of these problems. And I have courses about this as well. And I talk about what is important and kind of understanding things. But I thought it was important for me to do a podcast about this because there are several problems, in my opinion, with genetic testing. Number one is the tests themselves. And when we're looking at sequences of DNA and trying to figure out one base pair out of a bunch that is off, it actually takes multiple passes to do that. And by multiple passes, I mean that they feed the same DNA into the reader multiple times. And I've talked to different geneticists who've said that somewhere between 1,500 and 2,000 repetitions is really needed to get an accurate reading. Because what happens is that the reading is imperfect. And so if you only do a couple, which is what most of these tests are doing, particularly if it's like the 23andMe or the Ancestry, they're not really, it's not looking for the sequence in that way. It's looking for other factors. Even though they give you the data, that data may not be accurate. So if you're making clinical decisions based on this kind of cheap test, I don't think it's a really good idea. So that's the first problem with the test. And the other thing is that MTHFR, for example, is, I think the molecular weight of the molecule is 78,000, which is a gigantic gene. And so when you're looking at basically one or two areas of that we know of, right, where they're saying, oh, there's a problem there, maybe there's corrections of that quote-unquote problem somewhere else that we just don't know about yet. And in my experience clinically, I have had people who are MTHFR homozygous for either of the two big ones, the C677T or the A1298T variation. I'm not going to call it a mutation because it's not a mutation, it's a variation. And some of them have no problems whatsoever. Some of them absolutely need methylfolate, and some of them do poorly with methylfolate. And if you listen to some of the people out there, Gary Bracca comes to mind because I've heard that name from multiple patients who have taken methylfolate on his recommendation, and they've done really, really poorly as a result of it. And they call me to kind of fix the situation. That, like, doing it based on that test is not the right choice. It's not the right solution. And I think that here's the issue, and this is the analogy that I gave to someone earlier today. I live in Hawaii, and there's these buildings that are having, some of the new buildings have some problems, particularly with pipe. This piping is called PEX piping, leaking. And I've heard stories where they'll confer with the plans of the building to find where the manifold is so that they can remove the piping and replace it. And what ends up happening is they drill where they think that the manifold is, and it's not there. And it's like, what is going on? And this is the really interesting things. I was thinking about this, like, this is such an amazing analogy for the genetics, right? We're expecting something to behave in a particular way because of the genetics. And what's happening is we're not seeing that. And so as a clinician, to make a decision based on the genetics in this sort of framework, obviously if you're dealing with something like sickle cell anemia or cystic fibrosis, much smaller genes, by the way, you know, so one base pair change is going to have a bigger impact, but that's a different type of condition than the condition of SNP variations, because sickle cell technically is a genetic mutation, not a SNP variation in the literature, although that might be reclassified now at this point, but I'm not totally sure on that. But when we make a clinical decision based on this, even though the symptom is not the same, that creates problems, right? And I think that we need to understand that the body changes in response to the environment. And that's what epigenetics is. So epi means on top of the genetics. And this is a new field, really. I mean, it's probably only 20 years old, although there were some scientists back in the 80s who suggested that maybe knowing the DNA and what the codes are like isn't going to give us as much information as we think. And, you know, I've said this in other podcasts. We expected to find 100 to 150,000 genes in the human body. They found 23,498, something like that. The number keeps getting revised. It goes down, it comes back up. But it's in the 20-ish thousand number of genes. That doesn't explain the diversity and complexity of humans. What does is when you understand that not all the genes are working or being turned on at once, like, we have tons of DNA, we don't know what it's for, and we don't know what it's doing. And so the question is that having an impact on things? Possibly. So we're going to take a quick break, and on the other end, I'm going to talk more about the mechanisms of epigenetics and kind of how this impacts us and sort of what we're seeing right now clinically, because I think this is very important in terms of treatment and what vitamins people are taking. So stay tuned. Hello, and welcome back to Ask Dr. Gill. I'm your host, Dr. Gill Winkleman. And if you have any questions or comments, please feel free to send me an email at info@askdrgill.com, askdrgill.com. You can also check out my website at askdrgill.com. And on that site is a form you can fill out. And if you want to schedule with me to see me as a patient, you can use that form to do that, and or get a consult as well. And the other thing I will mention is I do have courses on why folates make us more anxious. And those courses are meant for people to understand when to take folate, what other B vitamins might be helpful if you are struggling with folate, or if you're not getting the benefit from folate that you would expect. So check those out. Those I've gotten good feedback on those courses, and they've been helpful for people. And the long one goes into way, way, way more detail than just folate in terms of how to deal with anxiety, but also other mental health issues. And it's fairly comprehensive for what it is. And, you know, I mean, it's hard to hit all of the edge cases, which there's a lot of, and there's a lot of them because of epigenetics. So what's interesting about the epigenetics is that what's in the environment affects how our DNA is working. An example of this is when a chameleon or some kind of lizard reptile changes colors in response to the environment. And that's an epigenetic function that's happening in its body that allows that to happen. And we see this in development early in childhood, in utero, for example, as well. The body is going to respond differently based on what the mom is eating, doing, and so forth. And so what we see clinically is that people who are responding well to a particular vitamin stop responding well as a result of something that shifts. And we don't really understand this. And the biggest example is vitamin B6. Now, in the literature from before the year 2000, there was a side effect seen whereby a patient would have high chance of neuropathy if they were taking very high doses of B6. Now, the doses we're talking about are above 500 milligrams per day. And with the Walsh protocol, we don't give anything close to that. But we do see issues now, and I've been seeing more of this happening over the last 5 to 10 years. And I'm not entirely certain what is causing this. And what happens is that people have reactions to the B6. So it's not necessarily neuropathy. They might feel more anxious. They might feel more tired. They might feel whatever it is they're feeling. There are more of it happening than there was when I first was in practice, and really for the first, say, 15 years of doing this type of medicine. And one of the things about B6 that's interesting is it is responsible for over 350 reactions that we know of in the body. And it's very possible that the levels of inflammation are turning this off. Now, Dr. Walsh believes, based from his research, that there is something happening that's changing the epigenetics of how B6 is working. Now, the treatment's basically the same. We need to get the B6, we need to sort of flush things out so the B6 can work. And once it does, then people can tolerate that. And it's not necessarily a comfortable process sometimes. It highlights something that's important, which is how the body changes in response to things in the environment. And I think that there are pieces of this that may be related to processed foods, for example. The body will shut things down as a result of not knowing what to do with the chemicals that that have been added into the food supply. It could be related to heavy metals. It could be related to environmental toxins like plastics or some kind of synthetic compound that's in our buildings or our clothes or something. But what's happening is our bodies are shifting in ways that we don't fully understand. And this is an interesting piece if you decide to do Walsh Protocol, that it's not, again, it's not about the genetics. There is nothing in the genetics that will necessarily help you feel better. And I'm sure there's someone listening who's going to be thinking, well, my doctor did the genetic tests and found I'm a fast comb T or I'm a slow comb T or I have MTHFR. And I would say that there's a correlation there, not a causation. In other words, if you were to look at everyone who should have fast comb T and do a protocol for that, it is not going to help everybody. It will help some people, but we're not seeing what we think we're seeing. And I think it's really, really important to understand that with the genetic testing and how the epigenetics is impacting things. So anyway, that's what I've got for you today. I hope you've enjoyed this, and hopefully you got something out of this. And if you have questions, like I said, feel free to email me at info@askdrgill.com, askdrgill.com. And if you have any questions or comments about this, you can leave them below, and I will answer them, particularly on the website, but also if you leave the comments on YouTube, I'd be happy to get back to them too. Thanks so much, and you take care.